And we can't forget that stopping someone and searching them on a pretense or for, frankly, no good reason at all, that is surveillance. Stopping someone while they're driving and asking them some questions and seeing if they trip up, that is also surveillance. We can't just think that this is about technology. What it is about monitoring a community. And we need a comprehensive evaluation of this trend, and we need to talk about how to fix it in Congress.
We've been speaking with Alvaro Bedoya of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. His articles, The Color of Surveillance and Why I Walked Out of Facial Recognition Negotiations, can both be found on Slate.com. Alvaro Bedoya, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need.
Hi, Paul Fisher. From WBAI then and WBAI now. Tired of pesky programs interrupting our fascinating fundraising drives? No problem. Don't touch that dial. We can sell you conspiracies and miracle cures till the sun goes supernova. Or you can help WBAI again become a station known for programs, not just products. How? Thought you'd never ask. Become a BAI buddy. That's a minimum $10 a month donation for each of the next 12 months. Help end the heartbreak of psoriasis cures and other lotions, potions, and nostrums sold on the radio by sending us money to make radio. Go to WBAI.org, our website, and become a BAI buddy.
This is Jordan McLean, Deputy Director for Make Music New York.
Spend an hour with me investigating the public and hidden lives of music makers and presenters on the show we're calling Making Music.
Join us every Friday in March from 2 to 3 p.m. on 99.5 WBAI.
In partnership with Make Music New York.
The New York Peace Film Festival will screen 10 films April 1st through April 3rd at All Souls Unitarian Church on Lexington Avenue at 80th Street in Manhattan. Wide-ranging topics include being illegal in America, being Iranian in America, finding a peaceful path under occupation, life and death after Fukushima, reconciliation of vets and anti-war activists in Montana, a retrospective of Scottish peace activist Brian Quinn's life, and getting teenagers from both sides of three conflict zones together to draw what peace would look like. For more details and ticketing, go to NewYorkPeaceFilmFest.com. Join us Friday, April 1st at 7 p.m. for our kickoff party. See trailers from films and talk to filmmakers. That's New York Peace Film Fest, April 1st to 3rd. All Souls Unitarian Church, Lexington at 80th Street in Manhattan.
Does this sound familiar? I might need these papers one day. Liquidation and going out of business stores are my refuge. When I lose weight, this will fit me again. I know I put my MetroCard and my keys somewhere. Does this sound familiar? Well, you should attend the workshop, Decluttering Your Life, From Chaos to Clarity, and the Effect on Physical, Mental, and Spiritual Well-Being, Tuesday, March 29th, 4:30 to 6:30 p.m., 215 West 125th Street in Harlem. For more information, call 646-639-4979. That's 646-639-4979.
This is Harvey Pekar, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported radio in New York. Is that okay? What do you want me to do, a bunch of them?
say you're my earth.
My earth.
You're my earth.
You're my earth.
Sweet paradise. I say you're
listening to WBAI Radio live here at 99.5 FM and on WBAI.org. This is Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis in studio with
Paulette Spencer.
And we are also here sharing this space and this time with you, our beloved listeners of WBAI and of this program, Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. And we do have a guest coming up because Paulette has scheduled a very cool segment, which we're going to have in just a moment. And then following that, we will be inviting you to join us with your phone calls. And we'll have a bit of a conversation about what's going on in the world and in our lives.
Today we had a meeting of the Heart of Mind live at the Commons, and it was a healing circle and spiritual support group. We did energy healing, and there were actually four healers in the group today, which was nice.
Lovely.
And so our next event is scheduled for next month. It will be April 20th, I believe. And so you'll be able to make a connection, at least at that point, if not sooner. So let's hear a little bit more music, and then we'll be back with our guests. And we're going to hear Abangoma, the healers from Hugh Masekela.
Spencer for Heart of Mind Earth at Midnight, and we are quite pleased to have with us this evening Mr. Calvin Ramsey, who is a playwright and documentary filmmaker, and I'm happy to welcome you, Calvin. Welcome you to the airwaves and WBAI.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I know that you are quite a creative soul, and we wanted to discuss maybe some of the work that you've done, specifically the Green Book Chronicles. And I understand a bit about it just from learning about it from you over these past few days. But could you please tell the audience what the Green Book Chronicles are?
Well, the Green Book Chronicle, it's a film about the Green Book. And the Green Book was a travel guide. The official title was the Negro Motorist Green Book. And it was started back in 1936 by an African-American letter carrier in Harlem. And he kept his publication going from 1936 up to 1964. And this publication was needed because African Americans were not allowed to have public accommodations on the open road while they were traveling, and they were not allowed to be members of AAA. So the Negro Motorist Green Book, later it was called just the Green Book, was essential for African Americans traveling during this period of Jim Crow.
And so how was the information compiled?
Well, Victor Green started in the Postal Service as a letter carrier in Hackensack, New Jersey, in 1913. That was the same year that Woodrow Wilson was elected president, same year that the National Alliance of Postal and Federal Employees was also established. Victor Green got married in 1918. He moved to Harlem. But the information was compiled through African-American mailmen. There were some women, but back in the early 30s, most of the letter carriers were men. And so these men all over the country would send in information to Victor Green, of places where people could stay, where they could rest, get refreshments, they need a doctor or a dentist. And this collection just grew and grew over the years. And 95% of the businesses that were listed in the Green Book were African-American-owned businesses.
And how did you learn about the Green Book?
Well, you know, I tell young people, because I have a children's book called Ruth and the Green Book. When I go to schools, I let kids know that I'm old enough to remember some of these days. And one little girl asked me, had I ever seen a dinosaur? She thought I was that old. I told, no, this was not ancient history. This was modern history. But I have some friends that I met years ago in the 70s in California when I was living out there. And I lost contact with these people. And about 20-some years later, I was in Atlanta living, working in the insurance industry. And I went to Home Depot to buy a lawnmower for my youngest son so he could start cutting the grass. And so I ran into one of the people from California from the 70s. They recognized me first. I didn't see them. And they invited me by their home. And they were, you know, married at this point, Tony and his wife, Patricia. They had 8 children. When I met them, they weren't even dating. So this was quite a surprise. At least I didn't know they were dating. I think they were dating, but it was kind of a secret. And so their oldest child was named Little Tony. And a year later, Little Tony was killed in a car accident. He was 18 years of age. And I went to the funeral outside of Atlanta. And the grandfather came down from New York, Mr. Ed Smith, and as we were sitting in the backyard, it was his first time in the Deep South, and we were talking after the service, and he looked right at me and said, you know, I was looking for a Green Book, and I never heard of the Green Book, and I said, what's the Green Book? And he started explaining it to me, and it just fascinated me, and at the time, I was on Emory's advisory board, Emory University in Atlanta. And I went over to Emory. I was on the board of Rare Books and Manuscripts. And they did not have a copy of the Green Book. But the Woodruff Library over at the Atlanta University Center had 2 copies of the Green Book. And Atlanta University Center is a collection of 6 schools, Morehouse, Spelman, in Morehouse Medical School and Clark Atlanta University, and theological school there as well. So they all used this library, and I went there, and they had two copies of the Green Book, and they made me copies of copies. And so from that, I went further into my research, ended up writing a play, and then a children's book, and then a documentary film. But that's how I found out about the Green Book. It literally fell on me. And on my dedication page in my children's book, I dedicated the book to little Tony, the young man who was killed in a car accident.
Hmm. And the actual Green Books themselves, how are they organized? Are they organized by state, by service? And how often were they produced?
Well, it was published yearly. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of years during World War II when they weren't published at all. But it's alphabetical order, and it's done by states. And within that states, it's the listing of cities and towns in alphabetical order.
And I remember you're mentioning at some point that the ways that information would be gathered were through the ladies of the house.
Well, you know, back then, I'm talking about the 30s, a lot of the women worked in the home, or maybe they had businesses in the home as well, but most of them were homemakers, and the men were working outside the home. It's totally different now, for sure. And so these mailmen, just like today, the mail carrier in our neighborhoods know more about the neighborhood than anyone because they know what kind of mail you're getting. They know whether or not the house is in the area or being well kept. In the city, it's a little different because of apartments. But in these small towns and in rural areas, the mail person, the letter carrier, has a good sense of what's going on in the neighborhood. And so these guys, mostly guys, there were very few women then who were letter carriers. These African-American mailmen would ask the lady of the house, the woman of the house, and they would share the book with them and tell them what they were doing. And this went totally, totally against their job description. And so when the homemaker would hear this, if they agreed to it, they would be listed in the Green Book as a tourist home, something like a bed and breakfast today, but it was just regular homes. And so a lot of the Green Books, the listing, if it was Mr. and Mrs. Brown, in the Green Book listing, it would be Mrs. Brown. So the women, I feel, the African-American homeowners, homemakers, really were vital in keeping this publication going as far as being a backbone for the traveler. A lot of these towns did not have African-American motels or hotels. And some of the hotels that were in some of the larger cities really weren't suitable for families. They were mostly suited for traveling salesmen and men who worked on the railroad.
And what became of those books? I understand that they are now part of a collection at our local library here in New York City. Am I correct?
Yeah. Well, the Green Book now, it's a rare book. Last April, a 25-cent Green Book sold at the Swan Gallery for $22,500. The books were a 6x9, about the size of a Jet magazine. It would fit in the glove compartment of your car. And these tourist homes, there were no phone numbers in the Green Book. You pretty much could just drive up, knock on the door, and say, I'm traveling. So you listed in the Green Book, and we need a place to stay. It kind of went like that. After Mr. Green's dream, Victor Hugo Green's dream was one day to go out of business. He was looking forward to the day that the Green Book would be no longer needed. Then he would know that African Americans would have full accommodations on the open road. So he was looking forward to that day. He retired from the post office in 1952. He died in 1960. He didn't live to see that, but his wife, Alma, kept the Green Book publication going for 4 more years.
Hmm. Wonderful. I know that you've created a children's book, as you mentioned earlier. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. Well, Ruth and the Green Book, the children's book, I never thought I would do a children's book. It's kind of came out of me calling and researching, and I felt like it was something needed. Most children know, students know about the Underground Railroad, but this period of American history sort of fell through the cracks. This whole period of Jim Crow and actually Jim Crow and traveling. So I was fortunate enough to write a children's book and to get an agent, and from that I got a world-class illustrator, Floyd Cooper, who had won the Coretta Scott Children's Book Award for illustrations 4 times. And it all kind of, it sort of just came, it kind of came together. But the book is takes place in 1952. Ruth is an 8-year-old little girl traveling with her father and mother from Chicago to see her father's mother in Selma, Alabama. And it's a journey where the family is headed out. The mother is from Chicago, and she was a little, she really wasn't sold on this idea of driving down to Selma. But the father was pretty keen on it. He felt like the country had changed a little since World War II, and he was in the Army. Now he's an insurance salesman, and he's doing quite well. Went to school on a GI Bill and just got a big promotion. And so he's driving his brand-new 1952 Buick from Chicago to Selma. And as they travel, they run into a couple of problems. The first one is that they stop, and Ruth wants to use the restroom. And after the father have gassed up and paid for it, he asked for the key, and he's denied. And this is Ruth's first time running into Jim Crow. And they have to explain this to her. And so this is quite upsetting to the young lady. This is her first time really being aware that her color is a barrier, or that some people who may be against her or may not like her or respect her because of her color. This is all new to her.
How old
and
is
so
Ruth
the family
in the story?
Is giving her a talk.
How old is the Ruth character in the story?
Ruth is 8 years old. And Ruth goes to a segregated school in Chicago, black school, and she goes to a segregated church. And she lives in a segregated neighborhood. So she doesn't have much contact with white people. And so her world has been somewhat protected and sheltered. So now they're on the open road, and whatever is out there is going to be coming her way. And this is the first situation, and they do their best to explain this to her, but it doesn't really make any sense to her what her parents are saying. But the trip goes on, and they go on. And then the next stop they make, they run in the same situation, trying to get a hotel room. And they end up sleeping in the car. And now it dawns on Ruth. She realizes that her mother had been cooking all week, and now she understands why. So there's no place for them to eat on the open road. And that's why all this food is in the car.
Hmm. Wow. That really kind of makes me go back, because I remember taking road trips with my family when I was younger, and I always thought it was just the adventure and the fun of cooking and not having to spend money, but it gives a whole new meaning to cooking, you know, in preparation for a long road trip.
Then the trip turns out, the trips get better. They stay with the father. He has some Army friends in Tennessee. They spend a night there, and Ruth get a chance to take a hot bath and sleep in a bed. And she's traveling with a teddy bear, Brown Bear. And throughout this trip, she is talking to Brown Bear. Ruth is an only child, and Brown Bear is her lifelong friend. And she's confiding in Brown Bear what she's experiencing and seeing and hearing. But the trip takes a turn for the better. The couple they're staying with, Eddie and Alice, see that Ruth is upset and sad, and they say, and they tell Ruth, keep your eyes open. If you run across an SO service station, you know, stop there because you can get help there and service there. And so Ruth sees an SO station, and she tells her dad, and he pulls in. And there they are treated with a lot of respect. An African-American man owns the service station, and he also is selling copies of the Green Book. And they buy a copy. And from that point on, the trip takes a major, major turn for the better. Ruth finds places to stay for the family, places to eat, places to shop. It's whatever they need on the open road, it's in the Green Book. And everything changes after that. The trip turns into a real trip for them.
And what is the significance of the Esso station? I know that there's
Well, the Esso station, today it's called ExxonMobil. Esso was was part of Standard Oil. That's why it's called Esso, you know, ESSO, but it really stands for SO, Standard Oil. Another way of saying it. Standard Oil was started by John D. Rockefeller, Sr., and his wife's family were abolitionists out of Massachusetts who had migrated to Ohio, and their home were part of the Underground Railroad. And their last name was Spelman, and the school in Atlanta, Spelman College, is named after John D. Rockefeller, Sr.'s wife's family. And so most people, historians and scholars and just plain old people, feel as though that Johnny Rockefeller Sr.'s wife is the one that got him to start this program to train African-American men to run these stations and to advise white owners and operators of Esso stations to also have an open-door policy to African-Americans who were traveling during this period.
Hmm. I'm going to ask Kathy if she has any questions for you.
I'm actually very much, very much fascinated by this whole story. Because even though I realize that, you know, you wrote this, you know, this story, well, at least the children's book as a, you know, a story, a fiction, it felt very real to me as you were telling it. It felt like, oh, wow, I could relate that I had experiences similar to that. And I'm fascinated by the historical research and the perspective you're giving us on how life has been for black people in this country. But what really struck me about that time period was how unified a people we were at that time, and how that we hung together and helped each other in ways that were exquisitely beautiful. And I don't see that in the world so much now, but I think that what you're doing is a real inspiration for what's possible and what we could be doing for each other even now. Maybe on different issues. And I was just wondering, how do we go about getting your book? I mean, we're not allowed to offer prices and stuff on the air, but certainly people are going to want to know how to connect with you and how to get a copy of your publications and maybe even connect in terms of whatever you're writing and working on right now.
Sure. Well, they can always go to my website. It's Calvin Alexander Ramsey Sr., SR.com, and that'll take them to places where you know, the book is being sold, and also it take them to where my play, The Green Book, is also being sold. I wrote a play before I did the actual children's book, and I had a reading of the play in D.C. a few years ago, and Julian Bond played Mr. Green. I had a reading of the play at Yale University some years
Do you have any recordings of those readings?
Well, not full recordings, just excerpts, but we had a full production, a world premiere in Atlanta where we ran for 10 weeks.
Wow.
But the play is also on the website and on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And I plan to bring the play to New York, and really across the country. The play is, a different year, 1953, and instead of being a road trip, it really takes place in a tourist home in Jefferson City, Missouri. And people are coming and going, and they all have different stories. And Dr. Du Bois is coming to Jefferson City, Missouri to speak at Lincoln University. So the whole town is excited about that. And so, but the play opens with Langston Hughes, who is in D.C., and he's down there to testify during the hearings. House Un-American Activities, HUAC hearings.
Wow.
And he's calling because he needs a place to stay in D.C., and he's calling Mr. Green on the phone. And that's how the play opened, with Julian playing Mr. Green, receiving the call from Langston Hughes. So it's historical, and it's educational, and I learned a lot from it myself. And I had a reading, I guess my earliest reading was at La Mama in the East Village. I was good friends with Ellen Stewart before she passed away, and she had five of my plays right there. And I would come up from Atlanta and have a reading, and then I would go back. But wow. the film, The Green Book Chronicles, is people who actually used the Green Book on honeymoons, on traveling, in the military, in other places. And those stories are pretty fascinating, of people who had the book and used the book, and some still own the books and things of that nature. So it's a, I guess I've been kind of wrapped up in the Green Book since 2001, and that was the year Little Tony passed away. And so since then, I've been sort of working with the Green Book. And at first I was like just a lone voice out there talking about this. Now there's a whole industry, which I'm glad of. There's folks doing scholarship work on this and other things as well. So I'm very happy about it. And one of the reasons why I moved from Atlanta to New York, Victor Green lives in Harlem, St. Nicholas Avenue, 938, right across from Duke Ellington at 935. So I feel like I needed to bring Victor Green back to Harlem and let Harlem and New York know about this man and his efforts.
Well, I would love to see that kind of a reading taking place right here at WBAI, so maybe we could talk about what it would take to do some kind of broadcast based on your work. I think it would be great.
That would be wonderful. That would be great.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, that would be a beautiful thing, and anything's possible. You can make that happen.
Yeah.
You can make that happen. And so, if you could please repeat your contact information for the audience in case they follow your work.
Okay. Well, it's Calvin Alexander Ramsey, and then it's senior, not the whole word senior, just SR, Calvin Alexander Ramsey, SR.com.
Okay.
And that's my website. And on there, they will see, information about the Green Book and about the play and also the film and about my other works as well. I've written 12 other plays, and this is a new life for me. Up until 2001, I had worked in the insurance business for over 20-some years, but I always wanted to write. I wasn't sure if I could write. And so I kind of jumped into this after 9/11 to follow my dream and passion. Mm-hmm. And, I've been very fortunate, and folks have been very, very nice to me. Directors, actors, you name it, scholars, historians, archivists, and really to help me move these projects along the way. And so I tell people it's never too late to follow your dreams. The big thing is to take that first step, and that's what I feel like I'm doing now. I'm kind of living a whole different life and a new life, and I get to share my information and my work with young people from the second grade to the fifth grade, and for older people with the plays and also now the film.
So this is, I'm very inspired. So tell people the name of the play, the name of the children's book, and the name of the film that you are connected to.
Sure. The play is Just a Green Book. Just a Green Book. And there's other green books out there. You know, I think the city has a green book. New York City, I think Gaddafi had a green book. But it's the green book, you know, with my name. And then there's the children's book is Ruth, R-U-T-H, Ruth and the Green Book. Mm-hmm. And that's in pretty much every public library here in the city, which I'm very grateful for that. And the play, I mean, the documentary is The Green Book Chronicles. And that film is not out yet. But there's a trailer online, a four-minute trailer, that they can see and hear some of the interviews. But those are the three projects.
Excellent.
And I recall watching a presentation you gave not long ago at the Brooklyn Historical Society that C-SPAN picked up. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was really quite wonderful and well attended, and the audience was so interested in your work, and I highly recommend that to anyone who wants to hear you speak for a good hour about your work. It's available mm-hmm. on C-SPAN 3.
Yeah, that was a few weeks ago, and the Smithsonian interviewed me right after that, and I think they have like a 1,000-word article that'll be out in their April edition. That's the Smithsonian Magazine. So I'm looking forward to reading it myself because they were very detailed and in-depth when they were asking me a lot of questions.
Beautiful.
So, yeah.
That sounds great. Sounds great.
And so on that note, I thank you for taking the time out to speak with us, and we will be following your work and promoting this to our listeners. I think it's extremely important on so many levels, and so relevant to what we're actually seeing now in the country. And I think it's important to educate the youth and also people who may not have heard of the Green Book about the rich history of the African American population here, and how, as Kathy mentioned, people bond together when things are rough.
But yeah, and that's the beauty of the whole experience is the whole experience. I tell young people, you know, there was a time when people would have their name in a book, and strangers would drive up and knock on the door and spend the night and share a meal. And sometimes the people would charge a little bit. Sometimes they wouldn't charge anything, but people would leave money on the dresser or under the pillow to show their gratitude. But there was it all wasn't all gloom and doom during this period. It really was a lot of love and a lot of sharing and a lot of people connecting and sharing stories and some friendships that lasted over the years and bonded. So it really was a stressful times, but it was also a lot of beauty and a lot of wonderful connections came out of this. And I'm very honored to be on this radio program. I mean, it's one of the hallmarks of freedom and liberty and progressive thought. So I'm honored to to be talking to.
Well, we're honored to have you as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well. Thank you. Mutual.
Mutual.
Yeah.
Well, and certainly we'll have you back again, and as your projects develop, most definitely. But I'm really would love to get put together some kind of radio drama with you and have this broadcast.
That'd be great. You know, I've been working with a local actor here, Arthur French. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks know Arthur. He was in The Trip to Bountiful with Cicely Tyson a few seasons ago on Broadway. And Arthur is a New York legend. And he was in one of my plays at La Mama some years ago, a play on Canada Lee. And Arthur is just, a great guy, and we can make this happen. I'd like to have Arthur involved in this on some level.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.
We should definitely work on that.
Okay, I appreciate
so,
it.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
And, same here.
We'll be in touch.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was fabulous, Paulette. Thank you for making that happen.
You're most such welcome.
And, yeah, so we had, that was a beautiful interview, and I'm captivated by all that we heard. So let's go to a little bit more music, and then take a few breaths, everyone, and we'll be integrating your calls in the remainder of the program. Our number is 718-780-8888. So stay tuned for more Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight.
Ladies and gentlemen, this next song comes from Tanzania. It's a song in Swahili, a love song. It simply says, Malaika nakupenda malaika, which simply means, I love you, my angel. Malaika nakupenda malaika. Nakupenda malaika, ningekuoa madiwe, ningekuoa dada, nashindwa na mali sina we, ningekuoa malaika, nashindwa na mali sina we. Nifanyeje kijana mwenzio, nashinda na mali sina we, ningekuoa malaika, nashinda na mali sina we, wo ningekuoa malaika. Nashindwa na mali sina wewe,
Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Ningekuwa mariwe, ningekuwa jaja, nashinga na mani sinawe. Ningekuwa mamalaika, nashinga na mani singawe. Ningekuwa mamalaika. Esa zasudu waduhu nyengu. Esa zasudu waduhu nyengu. Na minifo nyeji. Nashinga na mani sinawe. Ningekuwa mamalaika. Nashinga na mani sinawe. Ningekuwa mamalaika. Eba kirege.
See, we're back. You're listening to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. And we're listening to Malaika, a version by Angelique Kidjoe. And the first version was Miriam Makeba. They're both beautiful, but I think Miriam's was touched me deeper, a little deeper. Really, really exquisite, that particular song.
Yeah, it was recorded in 1974.
Yeah. Beautiful. So so we have lovely music for you. We had a really beautiful interview with Calvin Alexander Ramsey, and you can get more information at calvinalexanderramseysr.com, and you'll find out more about his work. And I was enchanted, actually, totally enchanted. The Green Book, Ruth and the Green Book, and the Green Book Chronicles. And we're going to be certainly exploring that more. I have to say that I was mesmerized by the story of Ruth as the little girl who was having this experience of, for the first time, of Jim Crow. And I can remember having that early experience in my life as well. I think most of us can, that we had to become aware that there was a problem. As soon as you reach a point, well, at least this is how it was in the 50s and early 60s, probably still now, you reach a point when you realize that the world is not as you might have imagined it, and that there are these perceived differences between people that I think all of us as children have no idea what this is about, no matter our race. And then we grow up in our families and move out into the world as children, and we discover that things are not as they should be. I actually remember the first time I was called nigger. I do. Speaking of which, and it wasn't, I was living in Long Island, so it was not like I was in the Deep South. And I was riding a bus to school, and the little girl next to me, you know how Charlie Brown goes, a little red-haired girl? I'll never forget this little red-haired girl, because she spoke to me so matter-of-fact, as if that was the natural name for who I am in my race. And I remember, and I guess I was sixth or seven, I don't remember, Exactly. But I was little, you know, going on the school bus, and I remember in my little girl mind looking at this little girl, and she was like using these words that my mother had told me were not nice words. But I could perceive that this other child had no idea what she was doing. Like, she was saying it as if somebody had said, this is called a computer, this is called a book, this is called a pencil, this is called a nigger. And to me, when she used that word, I had that perception that this was something that was not integral to who she was, but what she had learned. And what struck me about growing up in a dominant culture such as any apartheid culture is that you grow up having a sort of a bilingual mind. You have to negotiate the world on so many different levels that the child who's growing up as part of the dominant culture doesn't ever have to learn to navigate. And so I find it interesting, which is why I resonated in a way with that story, is because I'm remembering these encounters. And, you know, this particular encounter wasn't especially hurtful because I had enough wherewithal to understand that this kid almost didn't really know what she was talking about. But even at that moment, I was aware that her parents knew what they were teaching her and probably felt the negativity and the hatred of that word. And so here I am, 6 or 7 years old, understanding that the kid is being taught these nasty words, that their parents are actually hateful and believe in the words. And, you know, so, and I'm remembering now when I had that encounter on the school bus, I don't remember the conversation that came before it, but that means my parents would have had this conversation with me preschool so that I would be prepared enough upon encountering it to be able to negotiate that situation. So it's interesting that that things haven't really changed very much, you know. That was, what, 50-some-odd years ago when I was 5 or 6 years old, 7 years old. And kids are still going through the same thing now. Very, very interesting that it hasn't changed dramatically.
Yeah, I think my experience with racism was stuff that I think sticks out closest to my, or foremost in my mind, was stuff that happened abroad. You know, and I realized that there are places where you go where people don't really travel out of the country very much. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the mindset is somewhere in the middle of the 1800s. And so...
Yeah, well, we see a lot of that, don't we?
Oh, yes.
And, yeah, it's interesting how... and even our current political election is really demonstrating how much ignorance dominates the consciousness of certainly Americans, mm-hmm. if nothing else. And perhaps that's a bit rough of a judgment to make, but you know, it just seems that that's what is prevailing at this ignorance. And to me, that's really what racism falls under, the category of ignorance. There is hatred with it, but primarily it's, for me, a demonstration of ignorance.
And I think the tragedy is you have these figures that then go and exploit that ignorance.
Yeah, and encourage...
Yes.
Feed the flames.
Yes.
We won't mention any of those characters'
names.
No, we
will not.
We'll let our callers mention
yes.
their names. The number is 718-780-8888, 718-780-8888, if you'd like to call and contribute to this conversation. I think it's interesting the way the ages, as time goes by, changes and how the overall consciousness of society changes. Because I recognize that back in the 50s, there was a lot of contention. I was born in the 50s, but I didn't have political consciousness. I was a baby, didn't think much about it. But I became fairly conscious of politics upon all the assassinations. You know, the assassination of Martin Luther King and President Kennedy and Senator Kennedy and Malcolm X. And once I saw all these assassinations occurring is when I became politically activated, even though I was quite young when it happened. I don't know if you were quite out of childhood when that was going on, but I was still young. I mean, I was in, because I think I was in third or fourth grade when Kennedy was assassinated.
Yeah, I was just born.
You were just born, so you didn't quite get the impact of it.
No, but I think with me, what made me, I guess, politically aware was the politics. I was very much aware of how media shapes your sense of reality. Mm-hmm. And so growing up, with my mom, we'd have these conversations, you know, about foreign affairs. And at that time, it was the Red Scare. And you know, and I remember we would talk about the balance of power in the world and what that would mean if one end of the balance were to disappear, what would happen. And so I was very conscious.
We're kind of seeing that today, aren't we?
Yes, we are. But I was very conscious of that, mm-hmm. of how media is used to engineer your sense of reality just by that little light coming from the box.
Mm. Well, that's very fascinating. I did not have that insight at a very young age. To tell you the truth, my family was not very political. My mother's consciousness was more spiritual, so that was more of our conversation. But it's interesting how we all get activated in some fashion and find ourselves popping out of the mainstream and on the fringe, as most of us here at WBAI live on the fringe. And to me, that's a very wondrous place to be, because it means that you do have a level of consciousness, you're aware of what's going on, and you're not manipulated and controlled by the media as you describe. I remember really, really learning about the media in high school, because I studied advertising. Hmm. And I was really quite horrified the levels to which the whole system was designed to manipulate and control people and program people. And so I didn't stay in it very long, but it was enough to really see, for me to really see. I mean, the extent to which they would manipulate images even for subliminal programming.
Sure.
And how they would have passages embedded in things and flashing of words, you know. So you see in science fiction films these things happening, but this is really what they do in advertising, or at least they did when I was going to school. You know, you'd be watching TV and they'd be flashing words that are too fast for you to see with your naked eye, but go into the subconscious. And so the advertising is very, 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 very manipulative. And visual print advertising would have images airbrushed in that you wouldn't necessarily see with the eye, with your consciousness, but would penetrate into the subconscious. And so they systematically designed advertising to program people, of course, to spend their money and to become addicted to things. So that was kind of horrifying to me. I didn't want to participate in that.
I can understand why.
So I didn't really stay in the business very long. But then once I expanded on, you know, as well with the political dimension, I began to really see how the media controls. Like even in this election, you know, would these candidates really be so prominent if they weren't being pumped up by the media? Probably not. Mm-hmm. And it's even hard to gauge how popular anybody is, because we're getting a slice of the story. We're getting a manipulation of the candidates as well as their supporters. And the way that elections can be manipulated, there's no telling if the actual election is a real election. And in a sense, we can see that even with like the Bernie Sanders delegate count, like he's winning states, but he's not winning delegates. I'm like, how does that happen? So that it shows a gross level of manipulation of the whole situation. So we don't really, I suspect that, you know, well, I feel quite sure, Americans are not electing their leaders. It's a whole manipulation, and there's no telling what we're going to get.
Yeah, I think in my cynical self tends to look sometimes at some of this polling as just simply a way of measuring how effective they were in shaping your opinion.
Exactly. It's not a true poll, and especially since a poll is a question.
Right.
You're not asking people what they think. You're giving them a number of choices to. So it's really a manipulation. It's
absolutely
not real. Interesting. Well, the number is 718-780-8888. 718-780-8888. If you would like to join us with your phone calls, you're welcome to join us and let us know what's on your mind. So I have been working on another note. just to let people know, I offered a healing session for the fund drive, and we got a number of takers for a general healing session. So for those people who might have pledged, we are working on the list, calling people, and so it's nice to be able to do a fundraising premium that you can deliver personally without having to worry about buying a book or ordering something. But there is a necessity to connect, to schedule. So for those people who made that pledge, you can certainly be in touch and to facilitate, to speed it up if perhaps you're wanting to call and make that appointment. And you can send an email to myself, CatherineDavis@WBAI.org, and we can make the appointment. Or you can also send an email, heartofmindradio@gmail.com, if you want to connect in that way. And since we're giving out emails, why don't you offer your email?
Well, I've been using thenightreport@gmail.com.
Right, but we're going to correct
it's
that.
It's going to change.
Yeah, but for the time being,
yes,
you'll still be able to use that. And so I want to put that out there because, you know, I think about 30 people pledged, which is a considerable amount of folk. And I want to make sure that everybody gets their energy healing session. And gratitude for that donation to WBAI. Also this weekend, I'm going to be at the New Life Expo. And I'll have a table there for BAI. You can stop by if you're going to. Those of you who have an interest in the New Life Expo, it's a pretty cool event, 3 days. And it starts on Friday about 3 in the afternoon and goes till Sunday about 7. Of course, it closes overnight, but, you know, basically it's 3 days of events at the Penn Plaza Pavilion from March 18th, Friday through, actually Monday. But I'll be doing a lecture on Friday on vibrational healing at 9 p.m. It's a bit late, but you'll have a chance to enjoy all the different events and check out all the booths and see what's happening and then come to the lecture at 9.
Wonderful.
So hopefully people will do that.
And I understand you're going to be part of something on the 26th of March.
Exactly, and I would have forgotten that, and that is an event in the Bronx. I will look for the information. I believe I downloaded it, and I can remind everyone about it. It's going to be a... Why don't you talk about it while I look up for the details? Do you remember what it is?
It's a day I'm celebrating women's health. And I don't remember the school.
I'm going to look that up.
But it's near Yankee Stadium, 161st Street stop on the 4 train, or the River Avenue, 161st Street stop on the D or the B train. And I think you're scheduled to give a meditation class at 11 a.m. on Saturday, the 26th of March.
Yeah, that should be great. And the whole day is going to be fascinating, and there's going to be a lot going on. There'll be an opportunity for people to get free massage, as well as to participate as yoga and Zumba and all kinds of interesting ways people can get together and move their body, calm the mind, get a massage, and there'll be other stuff going on. And it's great because it's in the Bronx. You know, everybody comes to Manhattan and to Brooklyn for stuff. It's nice to have something going on in the boogie down Bronx, as they used to call it.
Yeah. They still do. Yes, they do.
Yeah, so it's cool. And so I found a flyer. I'm going to see if I can open it. And that way I can tell you all the details. We have a call coming in. Let's see. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you are live on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to say, this is the Science Guy. I just wanted to say that that was one of the most heartfelt interviews that I've heard in quite some time. I really appreciated it. And I also wanted to have everybody recognize that the equinox is coming up this weekend very soon as well.
Wow. Oh, okay. That's right. Always something going on in this world to capture your attention. So tell us about the equinox. What does it mean on an energy, astrological, seasonal, anything you would like to share?
Well, it's like the name itself says, it literally means equal night, but it's the time when the day and the night are equal. And that, of course, was just a recognition that the daylight starts to get a little bit longer each day. And it's the time, right now, the birds are out. The night before the equinox, the birds usually congregate in the trees around 4 o'clock in the morning, where they sing until the sun comes up.
Wow.
And one of the things that I find scientifically so fascinating is that the bird song actually stimulates the seeds to plant the cotyledon, or the roots going down. So the bird songs in the spring actually stimulate the plants to grow first downward, and then so they can send their shoots up through the ground.
Wow.
And we know this because in the years previous, when they've done the insecticides and they've eliminated all the bugs and whatever, the birds don't come and the plants don't grow as well.
Wow.
Even the simplest thing that we don't think is connected is completely connected. Also, the other thing, just from I I'm the science guy. The sun is at the angle in the sky right now where it is, because of the tilt of the earth and the angle of the sun, the rays that come through emphasize the yellow ray and the purple ray. And we notice that the crocuses that come up and the daffodils that come up are the yellow and the purple plants. So they're the initiators to let us know that spring is coming. Of course, yellow is the stimulating of the mental processes, and the purple, of course, is our what we call our spiritual or our soul mission. Hmm. So, you know, the fact that it's the equal day and equal night wants us to balance both of those out, and so that we start to grow ourselves and start to actualize what we're here to do.
Well, thank you. That was magnificent.
Yes, indeed.
That was really wonderful. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm just paying it back because the energy was so, it just filled my heart with just joy. And it's just wonderful to hear history and the way it moved you, Catherine. Mm-hmm. I could feel the vibration in your voice when you were talking about it. And hopefully, I mean, you've met me several times, but hopefully I'll see you at the expo this weekend.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
All right. Have a great, great morning.
Thank you. Both of you.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Wow, that was something. So the first day of spring is Sunday, March 20th.
Hmm.
So I'm going to get up and listen to the birds sing until the song comes up.
That's lovely.
Yes, I was hoping I didn't miss it because I'm like, well, I usually get up around 3 anyway, so I wake up, I'll say. I don't necessarily get up, but I do wake up around between 3 and 5, I usually wake up. So I'm going to definitely pay attention and listen to the birds so that my own roots can go into the earth.
Yes.
And I can balance my yellow and purple chakras.
Hmm. That was a really beautiful description.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. And it really gives you, you know, you have to pause and say, okay, now, if the universe is this synchronized and this integrated that the songs of a bird have to do with the season of growing, it's hard for me to think that that is not a plan in that. There's like there's a great beauty and divinity in the harmony of nature.
Hmm.
So if we want to know what divinity looks like, look outside your window. That's it. Doesn't have to be a big man in the sky. In fact, it's not. Anyway, the number here is 718-780-8888. 718-780-8888. If you'd like to join us. I think I'll play another piece of music. And Paulette, what would you like to hear at this moment?
Well, I would very much like to hear...
We have a whole lineup of music,
more than
we could play
at this juncture,
but there's a lot to choose from.
I would like to hear...
Well, we have a call.
Okay.
Let's go with that.
Let's go with the call.
And then we'll do the song. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm on the air, really?
You're live. Was that your intention? You have to turn off your radio to be able to speak.
Oh, okay. I just put the thing in. So this is, how you do it? Catherine?
Yes.
Lower?
No, just turn off your radio. And
okay. Oh,
then
it's way down low because I'm taping it. You know me. I'm an engineer.
Okay.
I don't know if you even recognize my voice, but I when I first met you in 83, I thought you were one of the nurses because you were so nice.
Okay, yeah.
Like during the International Women's Day, remember I'd bring you like tapes and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how you sound good. You sound good.
Thank you.
And like I tell people that like, you're a Qigong master. You went to Japan.
China.
I mean China. No,
yeah.
I mean I know China. I'm it's been a long day.
I know, me too. Me too.
But I know I said Catherine Davis, you know, and she's a Qigong master. You know? I mean, it's anyways, I did pledge and I'll be having a session with you in Bay Ridge.
Oh, good, good.
So prepare yourself, bring your hard hat. Because you know me, Kathy, you know.
I don't have a hard hat, but my hands are very gentle.
No, but you know what I'm saying? You need your hard hat with me, you know, because, I mean, things have gotten so strange so quickly.
Okay. Well,
But I'm happy this new space at BAI seems really hopeful.
Yeah, we have hope. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
And we'll get together and do that session.
Okay, well, that's, you know, it's regardless. I'm still waiting for my Bob Fass. You know, I like to say, they should make T-shirts where the professionals work for free.
You're right. I might actually use that.
That's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool.
No, because you know, because I like Dr. Pepper. You know, Dr. Pepper, the soft drink. So if you go on their thing, you can get I'm a pacifist.
Okay.
And you know, actually, two white guys asked me on the subway, "What's a pacifist?" I said, "Well, they want peace. They don't want war." And they said, "That's it." I said, "Basically, that's it." People are so stupid, so ignorant today or something. I don't know. It's like everybody's asleep. I think they're all inhabited by other beings or something. You know, like first-timers, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I said, luckily, am I talking too much?
You're fine. We're running out of time, unfortunately, but finish your point.
Okay, well, I was raised Roman Catholic parochial, okay, mm-hmm. till the fourth grade. Then, you know, I have a minor in theology, so I'm a lot of Zen Buddhist, because Zen is fun.
Yeah.
You know, because Buddhism could be very tough, but Zen is fun. Anyway, Roman Catholic parochial, I mean, like Flannery O'Connor said, she's, you know, the short story writer?
Uh-huh.
She said, like hell is a symbol. About the host and the wine, like when those bells ring, it becomes the body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ.
Right.
It's not like Flannery O'Connor, like hell is a symbol. She was a fierce lady. She died way too young of a painful illness, I think.
Yeah, well, that's why we have to start working towards healing those old wounds and the... You know, organized religion is responsible for a lot of wounding.
It doesn't matter, the religion. It is. But as far as like the Roman Catholic parochial, like you learn what Jesus taught. You know, like when Jesus walked. You know what I mean? It's like not like evil, like that it became. But like I said, Kathy, I'm ready. I'm here like 53 plus years. I'm ready for my release to come.
Okay, well, the idea, however, is to have the release and stay alive.
Right, but the thing is, Kathy, I've done everything. I've done almost, you know, I mean, there's still like I have a list of women I'd like to do still, you know, but it's, you know what I'm saying? I mean, honestly, it's like, thank God, thank the Lord, thank whoever that we don't believe in reincarnation, because the thought of coming back here, Kathy, is frightening to me.
Well, I do believe in reincarnation.
Well, the thought of starting over.
But there's a choice. You don't have to. I don't think there's any forced encampment. I think there's a choice. I'm going to take the next call.
Oh, you go. God bless. Well, we'll talk whoever, soon. Allah, whatever, or you know.
Thank you.
Okay, take it easy. Stay strong, my sister.
Okay, bye bye.
Bye bye.
She's right. I am going to need a hard hat or a hard head. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Good morning. How are you?
Yes, you're live. Hi. On the air.
Good morning.
Oh, yes, I have my radio turned down, and actually I was going to take a bath because I just got in from work, but I realized you were on, and I just want to say thank you because I actually became an active listener for the past month, and I've been able to heal myself every morning. Before I get up, I write down the things I'm grateful for, and I'm learning. But right now, I just want to address the situation that's happening in this country today, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, we're short on time, but go right ahead.
Okay, right. Okay, number one, as far as experiencing racism, number one, I'm 53 years old, loving America because I have no other place to go. But right now, I feel that there's some type of imbalance happening. I can't describe it because I'm not able to, but there's some type of imbalance allowing all the negativity coming out that everybody needs to know, okay? And as far as voting, I'm going to vote because I live through the Selma. I don't really prefer any candidate right now except for myself. But anyway,
I'll vote for you.
It's just that it's sad because the nonsense that's happening, and to hear just recently, I heard that Mr. Trump said if he's not the nominee for the GOP, there will be riot. Okay, that's another negative force that, you know, okay, fine, riot, but then who is it going to affect and hurt? You know, the folks that care about the country. And I heard last night about some gentleman said, well, if you don't like what's going on in this country, go back to where you came from. I'm a African-American woman, been here. My ancestors been here forever. I went downstairs to my mom. I said, well, where are we going to go?
It's
everyone's country, and I love it. And the fact is that everyone should get out and vote and just bypass all the negativity and get up with a positive attitude and pray to whomever you want to pray to. Mm-hmm. But know that we are in charge. And thank you for your program. I love you, and never met you, but one day I hope I do. But spiritually, I have.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. I appreciate
You're welcome.
It. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It is true. You do have to keep the balance, because looking out in the world, you're not going to find it. It's only inside that you'll find it. And in fact, the purpose of much that we see is to destabilize. So take it with a grain of salt, I say, and keep on keeping on. What else can we do?
I agree.
So we're going to go to Hugh Masekela. And is that, Hugh Masekela. What is it? Halesela?
Dikani. I don't know what that means, but I love this music.
Okay, so that's what we're going to hear. We want you to stay tuned coming up for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. And this has been Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis with
Paulette Spencer.
And we want to thank you all for joining us this great and beautiful morning. And don't forget, March 20th, get up at 4 a.m. and listen to the birds.
Yeah.
As they will be singing in the season of growing. Beautiful. I love that. Here we go, Hugh Masekela. And the name of the album is actually Still Grazing. Okay.
Haliseli di kanna Nfakomela di sawelwe kesera me Haliseli di kanna Nfakomela di sawelwe kesera me Take it, Sabo Hadi. Como se é que tá boa de... da goshin komu se ke sabu
morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, we catch up with a couple more reviews from Bad Persons, and then our guest, recorded last week, Lev Grossman, from Time Magazine and author of The Magicians. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. It takes, at the very least, 2 years for a major feature animated film to make it to the screen. A lot can happen in that time, which is why cultural references cleave to the time-tested. Star Wars is good, you might want to stay away from stuff like PewDiePie. Not sure how the Angry Birds movie is going to play 3 years after everybody has stopped playing the game. And you also want to keep themes deliberately broad. Whatever we had to say about the Ebola panic has already been said. We don't need to revisit it. So the producers of Zootopia, who announced production in 2013 and saw the release of their film a couple of weeks ago, are either very lucky or must be burned at the stake as witches, since clearly they could look into the future and see the current political climate we're presently sweating through. Ostensibly, the film is an anthropomorphized send-up of a buddy cop film with an eager rookie rabbit police officer voiced by Jennifer Goodwin, who's pounding the beat in the bustling metropolis of Zootopia, joining forces with a savvy con fox voiced by Jason Bateman to investigate a rash of disappearances among the populace. It's a fun film overall. Directors Brian Howard, Rich Moore, and Jared Bush managed to imbue their characters with personalities without losing sight of their animal natures, and they have designed the city as if it was actually built by animals, with separate biospheres that stand in for neighborhoods, and a beautiful, organic look overall. Here's the thing. In its opening weekend, Zootopia was a box office hit, becoming the biggest non-Pixar CG animated film to date and the most successful Disney animated film, topping even Frozen. A lot of people have seen the film, and among those masses has to be a fair proportion who, either before or after, put on their Make America Great Again baseball caps and went to cheer on the not-so-crypto-fascist Donald Trump as he spewed his bile. I don't know what those people were thinking when Zootopia reached its third act and the mysterious disappearances were revealed to be part of a conspiracy to marginalize a certain minority within the animal populace, to stoke ingrained fears of this group and rob those creatures of, for want of a better word, their humanity. I would hope that for some of those audience members, some spark of awareness would be ignited, that maybe they'd pause for a moment and think about what Mr. Trump was actually doing and where it might lead. What I do know is that Zootopia comes out at a time when we need to be talking about such things. There are distinct flaws to Zootopia's storytelling. Put it up against Inside Out, and there's really no comparison. But largely by accident, it becomes an important film to see and to consider. Elsewhere, in the new film Creative Control, an advertising executive in the near future, played by the film's writer-director Benjamin Dickinson, has to develop a marketing campaign for a set of augmented reality glasses. At the same time, he's falling out of love with his present girlfriend, played by Nora Zehetner, and developing an attraction to the girlfriend of his best friend, played by Alexia Rasmussen and Alex Gill, respectively. Very much like the 2011 film Another Earth, the science fiction element in which the exec uses augmented reality to build a virtual analog of his new crush is meant to comment upon the real-world drama. But very much like Another Earth, you get the sense that you could pull the science fiction and the film would still play out pretty much the same. Creative Control is beautifully photographed in black and white with occasional splashes of color, and at moments such as when Dickinson shows his character using the glasses to juggle the ongoing construction of his computer girlfriend, three text conferences, documentation for an upcoming meeting, and a video phone conversation with human science fiction concept Reggie Watts, the film does break through with some unique ways of expressing its themes, even if those themes happen to cover the somewhat well-trod and maybe not necessarily true idea that technology may be impeding human interaction. There's skill and wit going on with Creative Control, but at its core, it feels like it's walking down the same mumblecore road. Speaking about walking, about 20 minutes into the screening I attended of Terrence Malick's new film Knight of Cups, the exodus began. Wasn't a mass migration, but over the course of the next hour, a number of audience members voted with their feet on how they felt about Mr. Malick's non-narrative ruminations on Hollywood, the filmmaking industry, and his own place in it, in which Christian Bale, functioning as the director's surrogate, wanders through studio backlots, decadent showbiz parties, Las Vegas casinos, and on and on. Now, this was a preview screening with only a handful of press attending that I could judge, and the rest of the theater populated apparently by members of the Philadelphia Film Society. It was hard to tell in a darkened auditorium, but it did appear that most of the walkouts were older people. And by older, I mean older than me. And I'm old. And I really wanted to ask those people, did you manage to sit through The Notebook? Because if you're bailing on this but could tolerate that insipid heap of manure, I have no respect for you. Knight of Cups does have its problems, lots of problems. At some point, you begin to develop one-liners for Christian Bale's mostly mute pilgrim, such as he's a shoo-in for the Oscar for best meandering by an actor infamous for his onset tantrums, or, ladies and gentlemen, the only man in Los Angeles who has never heard of Uber. But Malick does largely seem to be sincere in trying to crystallize his thoughts and feelings in a daringly experimental way. There are whole swaths where Knight of Cups looks like than a ravishingly photographed home movie. But it was that beauty that held me there, that kept me connected and hoping that Malick would arrive at something deeper than the superficial nature of Hollywood and of Western civilization overall. He doesn't, not really. And still, I don't regret having seen this. This is a case where the trip is the thing rather than the destination.